Thank you for attending session 125, titled My Mormon Culture, A Cultural Psychologist's View on Being Mormon and Changing Mormon Minds. Before we begin, we ask that cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. Please keep that in mind when engaging in the question and answer portion of this session, following the remarks of this presenter. Those who cannot abide by those guidelines should refrain from commenting and will be asked to leave should they become disruptive. I have children, so I promise I will take you out if you're being disruptive. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. Take advantage of our symposium special by subscribing to Sunstone Magazine. You receive 7 issues for the price of 6 at the registration desk as well. Consider also purchasing Skull Candy official headphones customized for Sunstone. Personally, I'm very excited about this. Your support goes directly to keeping symposiums and 40 years of thoughtful dialogue alive and sustainable. Don't forget to check out the bookstore in the ballroom hosted by Benchmark Books. Consider purchasing a book or two to support Mormon studies and scholars. This session is 60 minutes long, and we ask that both audience and presenters and the presenter to keep within the framework of that time so we can allow for the next session to start on time. As a courtesy to other presenters and our attendees, we ask that immediately after this session, you clear the room and speak outside so other presentations can begin for the next session. Being Mormon means much more than simply believing in a certain set of religious teachings. For many, the unique shared values and norms of, quote, Mormon culture both interact with and transcend national, ethnic, and other identities. This has important implications for the way Mormons live their faith and deal with challenges to it. Using findings from cultural and social psychology, along with a series of personal anecdotes, this presentation aims to shed some light on some of the psychological underpinnings of Mormon culture and what it takes to undergo or cause major change within such a framework. Peter Levitt is a doctoral candidate in social psychology at the University of Arizona. He studies how culture and social identities such as race, ethnicity, and social class shape how people think, behave, and understand their own behavior and the behaviors of others. Peter Levitt.
Thank you all so much for being here. I'm very excited to share some of this stuff with you, and I know that for like an hour-long presentation, this one guy, it's a bit of a risk to take, so I hope that you enjoy what I'm about to share. To start, I'm just going to jump right in. I want you to think of a Mormon that you disagree with. These are some issues you might disagree on. There are plenty of issues to disagree on. I'm sure many of us in this room disagree with each other, but I want you to think of somebody that you disagree with. It could be a minor disagreement or a large disagreement. Somebody that you're very close with, just an acquaintance. The point of this isn't to think about what the right point of view is. The point of it is to think about the nature of our disagreements. So for my part, I'm thinking of somebody that I know who I disagree with about homosexuality. And that's not the only thing we disagree about, but it is one of the things that we disagree about. This person thinks homosexuality is unnatural and that gay marriage is bad. Our disagreement is mutual. This person also thinks I'm wrong. So with that person that you're thinking of in mind, think about your reaction to your disagreements with that person. I imagine some of us often feel confused by the people that we disagree with. Some of us might feel frustrated or angry. We might be very eager to see people change their minds about the thing that we disagree about. For my part, the person that I'm thinking of, it does confuse me sometimes thinking about that person's position, and sometimes it does make me angry. I feel like that position has consequences that this person doesn't fully understand. So I feel some of these emotions. But thinking about this, with that person in mind that you're thinking of and the person that I'm describing, I want to ask you a question. Why should that person think any differently than they do? And I mean this in two senses. One, given that person's background and life experiences, why would we expect this person to think any differently at this moment in time? And the other sense, given the nature of our interactions with this person, why would we expect this person to change the way that they think? And so in my talk, I'm going to discuss these questions. And I'm going to talk about two things in particular. So one, I'm going to talk about being Mormon, what it means to be Mormon. So in cultural psychology, we think of culture as these kind of broad, chronic social contexts that we're exposed to, and they result in shared patterns of norms and values, institutions and practices. And I'm going to talk about what that broad idea of culture means, what it means within the Mormon context. And then I'm going to talk about changing Mormon minds. And so how our own minds change within the cultural context that we inhabit, and what it takes for others' minds to change. So when we're thinking about our own minds and interacting with people that we disagree with, what's going on in their minds as it pertains to change. I also want to point out just at the beginning here that I'm not looking to provide an instruction manual for persuading other people to take your point of view, even though you may get some of that out of this talk. But the point is more to provide a cultural perspective on why changing minds is so difficult, and how we might create conditions that are more conducive to changing minds, even if no mind changing actually happens. I think the kinds of conditions that are conducive to mind changing are the kinds of conditions that will lead to more healthy and productive disagreements. And to start with, and this will come up throughout, but I really want to make sure that I say it right at the beginning, why I think culture is important, and it'll make sense as we go along. Culture is important because it tells us things like what is normal, what is good, who we are, how to think, and in the case of this talk, it teaches us how to disagree and what things are disagreeable. And then the other big component to this is that we rarely think about how our cultures influence us in this way. And so that makes us thinking about ourselves and thinking about others, it can make it difficult, and we might miss information. So with that in mind, I think it's important for you to understand a few things about me so that you know where I'm coming from, and I will use kind of my life as an illustration of some of the things I'm talking about. My Mormon journey so far involves a pioneer heritage. Before I was born, I had a long Mormon history. My polygamous great-great-great-grandpa has a town in southern Alberta named after him. I was born in the covenant to parents married in the temple, were faithful and active. I was raised in an active family in the church. We did the church things, attended church regularly, had family scripture study, family prayer, those kinds of things. I was a mostly good Mormon kid. I tried to obey the rules. I was sincere about trying to obey the rules, even though I didn't always do it. I served a 2-year mission in the Arcadia, California mission. I've had plenty of church callings, both before my mission and after my mission, YSA wards and that kind of thing, so I'm familiar with at least the ward level of functioning. I was married in the temple. I underwent a faith crisis. I was divorced, both civilly and in the temple. And today I consider myself an ex-Mormon. I've resigned my membership. So this is an important part of my Mormon journey, my Mormon culture. But I want to make it clear that I still consider myself a Mormon. And the reason for this is that Mormonism still colors the way that I see the world. And I suspect it always will color the way I see the world. Mormonism doesn't have to be a major or central part of my identity to acknowledge that it still has a tremendous effect on the way that I understand myself, the way that I understand others, and the way that I see my place in the world. And so, speaking of me, that person, when I asked everybody to think about people you disagree with, the person that I was describing was actually past Peter. So 23-year-old Peter thought homosexuality was bad and the gay marriage was wrong, and I was willing to speak up about it in college classrooms and with my friends and that kind of thing. I now feel differently about homosexuality, but I think it's useful to think about my past self and for us to think about the people that we disagree with, to think about, to reflect on the reasons for my past views on homosexuality. And how do we explain those things? Was 23-year-old Peter a bad person? Was he a hateful person? Was I a bigot back in the day? I mean, maybe I was. I'm not an objective observer, but these are useful questions to ask. On the other hand, could I have been motivated to be a good person while holding these views? Was my attitude about homosexuality a central or important part of who I was as a person? Was knowing that attitude about me, would that help you predict my attitudes about other things? And how much of a role did my Mormonism play in my past attitudes about homosexuality? And while the end results of my attitudes may have ultimately been the same, regardless of where those attitudes came from or why I was motivated, I think the perceived source of my attitudes probably affected the way the people in my life treated me. It's in my own self-interest to look back at myself and think, oh, I was motivated. I was well-meaning, you know. I wasn't a bad person. I was well-meaning. It's in my self-interest to explain my past behavior in that way, but the truth is, when we're thinking about other people that we disagree with, we rarely grant them that kindness of saying, like, oh, they're probably well-meaning, they're not bad people. It's difficult for us to explain their behavior in that way. And that's one of the things that stands in the way of us productively having disagreements, both in and outside of Mormonism. And so, that's the point that you should have been seeing. So this brings me to talking about the one big obstacle to disagreeing with other people, and particularly around Mormon issues. We often explain our disagreements in very simplistic and self-serving ways. And the reason for this, at least part of the reason for this, is that we fail to consider many contextual and cultural factors. And as a result, this affects the way that we think about and treat the people with whom we disagree. And so to bring it into social psychology a bit, in social psych, there's a large body of literature about attribution theory. It's basically how we explain the behaviors of others. And to put it very simply, when we see someone behave a certain way, we can explain that behavior in one of two ways. It's a dispositional attribution, so we'd say it's something about the person caused that behavior. In the image I have here, we could say that this man is clumsy and that's why he tripped. Or we can make a situational attribution. We can say that it's something about the situation that led to that behavior. This picture, we could say that the environment was very cluttered and that's what led to the tripping. And in our society, in Western society, we tend to over-rely on dispositional attributions. So when we see other people behave in a certain way, we tend to overestimate the degree to which that behavior is due to something about that person. And we underestimate the situational factors. So often when we are thinking about what led somebody else to think or behave in a certain way, we are often failing to consider a lot of important information. And so think back to past Peter. How might I or we have explained my past attitudes and behavior regarding homosexuality? Was it something about me, or was it something about the situation, the context that I found myself in? And would you treat me differently if you thought I was a bad person than if you thought there was some situational pressure contributing to my attitudes and behavior? And in line with this basic social psych stuff about how we explain behavior, when it comes to Mormon issues and our disagreements around those things, I think another problem that we have is that we tend to overestimate Mormonism's unique influence on a person's behavior. It's very tempting and very easy to notice that we disagree with somebody and to blame our disagreements on that person's particular brand of Mormonism or ex-Mormonism, as the case may be. And so, to sum up, I think that social psych suggests and personal experience suggests that we often rush to judgment of others without a complete enough understanding of how they got to where they are. And so, going back to this question, so with that all this in mind, what I'm going to try to do, I want to give you a reason to believe that we should be more careful about the way we use dispositional attributions and the way we explain things using people's Mormonism, and to consider a much broader collection of influences on people's attitudes and behavior. I'm going to try to convince you that there are plenty of cultural and non-Mormon things influencing the way we think about the world, and that we really should consider those things if we want to have productive disagreements with the people in our lives. So this brings me to, I want to introduce cultural psychology real quick. In the following slides, I'm going to discuss a few studies from social and cultural psychology. For the sake of the presentation, it will be a very simple discussion of each of these things. I'd be happy to discuss them in more detail later, but it'll be very, very straightforward for now. Cultural psychology is a branch of social psychology. If you think about social psychology as the study of the power of our social context, culture can be thought of as a broad, chronic social context, a specific type of context that we're exposed to. As I said at the beginning, culture is the shared patterns of norms, values, institutions, and ideas that characterize a person's life. And culture tells us what is normal and good, what kind of person is normal and good, and what the right way to act in the world is. So it tells us these very important, very central things for our lives. One way to conceptualize this, the idea of culture and how there are these different components that interact with each other to affect the way that we think and behave, I like to think of it in this way. On one end, we have these broad worldviews and societal values. And for the purposes of this, I'll use education as an example. So in the United States and Canada, we value education. There's kind of this nebulous abstract value behind education. And because we value education, it affects the kinds of institutions we have in society. So elementary education is compulsory. We have tons of colleges and universities. We encourage students to attend these, and we build them in a certain way because of this value we have about education. This, in turn, influences the kind of daily practices we engage in. If you're a student or a teacher, it means that you go to class and you learn in a certain way. If you're a teacher, you teach in a certain way. And then, in turn, all of these things influence the way we think about ourselves. So if I am a student, I learn to think about myself in a certain way. I learn to think about my role in the classroom in a certain way. Same as in the role of a professor, which is what I am now. And all of these things are constantly interacting with one another, to form these dynamic cultural systems that we inhabit. And so thinking about the culture as this dynamic system, when we study this, we narrow it down to more specific aspects. And so some of the cultural lenses that we study include things like whether or not people think the individual or the group is more important. What is the self? And what kind of self do you have? And what kind of self is it good to have? We think about what other people mean to us in our social worlds. How do we think about objects in the world? How do we categorize the things that we see in our worlds? And what do we see, what do we literally perceive when we look on the world around us? So these are just some of the questions that cultural psychology tries to answer and that I think are very informative when we're trying to think about why we think and do the things that we do, and why others think and do what they do. And so I'm going to talk about a few examples of this. One very commonly studied cultural dimension is that of individualism and collectivism, and then independence and interdependence. Individualism is a cultural system that places high value on the individual. And within such a system, uniqueness and autonomy are seen as very important. And people in these kinds of cultural systems tend to have independent self-views. So that means that they think of themselves as distinct from other people in their social worlds. Collectivism, on the other hand, describes a cultural system that places high value on the group. And so in such a system, conformity and cooperation are highly valued. It's important to maintain group harmony in such a system. And people in those cultural systems tend to have more interdependent selves. So you see yourself as inextricably connected to and overlapping with the other people in your social world. And this is an oversimplification, but generally speaking, we find that people in more Western cultures, like Canada, the United States, and many Western European countries, think of themselves, they're more individualistic and have more independent selves, while collectivism and interdependence are often studied in East and Southeast Asian contexts. Again, that's an oversimplification, but generally speaking, it's a one way to think about how these differences look. Our cultures literally cause us to see the world differently. On the left here, we have what's called the Mueller-Lyer illusion, and most of us in this room will probably perceive the line on the right as longer than the line on the left. And one explanation for why this might be the case is that we live in what's called a carpentered world in some of the literature on this, and that because we live in a society that has these square corners and we can use these corners to judge depth and distance, that we perceive those lines on the left as different lengths because it's a way of perceiving the world that we've grown up with and been accustomed to. And this is supported by the notion that when they show this illusion to people in nomadic hunter-gatherer cultures, they are much less susceptible to this illusion. More evidence of how we literally see the world differently comes from research on aesthetic preferences in art in East and West cultures. Researchers have found that Western art, on average, tends to have larger focal figures, lower horizons, and more contextual information than art from Eastern cultures. And you can see that demonstrated in the paintings on the slide here. And this also, if the researchers asked research participants in a laboratory setting to draw a house in a landscape scene, the same things would happen. Western students would draw larger houses and higher horizons, and the East Asian students would draw smaller houses, more other things, and lower horizons. Or, I think I got that backwards, the lower horizons for Western students, higher horizons for the Eastern students. Our cultures also lead us to categorize our worlds differently. Humans are what psychologists like to call cognitive misers. We like it to be easy when we think about our world and the objects in it, and so we develop these rules to help us categorize the things in our world. And sometimes we use different rules for grouping things together based on our cultures. So the words I have here, one of them doesn't belong. Who thinks that cow is the word that doesn't belong? How about chicken? How about grass? Okay, almost everybody says grass. And that's what we would expect. In Western cultures, we tend to group the cow and chicken together. Cow and chicken share the attribute of being an animal. So we group them together. Grass is the odd one out. However, in many Eastern cultures, cow and grass are the ones that go together. Cows eat grass. Chickens don't eat grass. And so cow and grass share a relationship that the other words don't. So this is, again, another example of how our cultures really deeply influence us in ways that we aren't aware of and hardly think about. To get a little more into classic social psychology, we form social groups very easily. One classic study of this, a researcher showed a group of young boys a series of paintings by either Paul Klee or Vasily Kandinsky, and after this exercise, arbitrarily told half the boys that they were Klee people, half of them that they were Kandinsky people. And this arbitrary grouping imposed by the researcher was enough to make the Klee boys more generous towards members of their own group, to the other Klee boys, and less generous to the Kandinsky boys, and vice versa. So this very arbitrary, very simple, minimal group difference was enough to make them behave differently towards each other. And so there's plenty of research in social psychology and cultural psychology that tells us that we think about our groups in very predictable ways. We, very simply put, we prefer our in-groups, and we tend to dislike and derogate our out-groups. And I also want to add that things like we talked about before, the individualism and collectivism, that those cultural ingredients will have an effect on the kinds of people we think belong in our in-group and the boundaries of our groups. And so I just wanted to bring that up as an example of how a lot of these things are always interacting. And I want to point out that a lot of research in social psychology shows how our group memberships shape our thoughts and behavior, even if these groups are arbitrary and imposed by somebody else. And so in this picture here is a picture of Jane Elliott's classroom back in the, I think it was the 70s when she did this. But this is a classic demonstration of this. She would she would group her class into blue-eyed students and brown-eyed students and tell them that blue-eyed students were smarter and they were better students and they were better behaved. And the brown-eyed students were not as smart and they were poorly behaved. And her saying that and putting some collars on the brown-eyed kids so that they could tell themselves apart, telling the kids that was enough to change those kids' thoughts and behavior. The blue-eyed kids, when they thought that they were the good kids, they behaved better and they performed better. And this is, a very powerful example, but this kind of thing has been shown in social psych in so many different studies. And so the point of all this, of me sharing these things, and it's not even close to all the research that's been done. There's so many other very, very interesting studies that would help me make this point. But the point I want to make is that culture is deep within us, and it is all around us. It affects our perceptions, our cognitions, our emotions, our group affiliations, and how we feel about our groups. We are influenced by many, many cultural contexts. So, the point is that there are many of these things influencing us at any given time. And then the main point of all of this is that we often fail to consider the extent of this cultural influence, especially when evaluating people we disagree with. And so with that, I want to talk a little bit about what it can mean to be Mormon. And so in one sense, it means that anyone who identifies as Mormon probably shares a few things in common. At its most basic, Mormons share things like their scriptures, some of the rituals and practices that define Mormonism. We have a shared terminology. You all know what I mean if I say a deacon or priest. It's not the same thing as it means in the Catholic Church. When I was describing my Mormon past, I didn't have to tell you what a pioneer heritage meant or what born in the covenant meant, because these are these linguistic things that we share in common that are part of our Mormon culture. But there are also a lot of things that are sometimes thought of as part of Mormon culture that aren't necessarily universally shared among Mormons. Things like church ball and green jello and funeral potatoes. Although I will say that funeral potatoes are a big part of my Mormonism. I'll say that. But you don't actually have to participate in any of these things to know that they are part of that shared system of Mormonism. And it helps you identify other Mormons and feel like you belong to that Mormon culture if you're aware of these things. But acknowledging this, that there are these parts of Mormonism that we see as Mormon, even though we may not ourselves participate in them, it also kind of means acknowledging that there are a lot of things that we might think of as uniquely Mormon that are not as unique and limited to Mormonism as we might be inclined to think. And so when we disagree with a Mormon or an ex-Mormon, we might be overestimating the role of that Mormon identity in that disagreement. And so despite these Mormon values and artifacts that we share, although those rituals and everything else, it's clear that there are many different ways to be a Mormon. I mean, the theme of this conference is many Mormonisms. I am sure that in this room we have many different varieties of Mormonism. And why are there so many? Because Mormonism isn't our only culture. So I hope at this point it's clear that there are so many other things influencing our thoughts and behavior that it's overly simplistic to say that the only or most important thing about somebody is that they are Mormon or ex-Mormon or whatever. And I know that people rarely say it in that kind of strict sense, but I think people often tend to give a lot of weight to somebody's Mormon or religious identities. And when it comes to religion and worldviews, these differences can be a really big deal. the differences between Mormons influenced by a variety of cultural factors. So to illustrate this, I want to talk about some other parts of my early life journey. So I'm going to illustrate some other cultural ingredients that led me to think and behave in the way that I did and do. So I was born and raised in Western Canada, English-speaking Canada, which is important. I am a white, straight, cisgender male. I was raised primarily in rural small towns, and my family was lower socioeconomic status, so we had a little bit less money, fewer resources than a lot of the other people in the communities I was part of. And so I'm going to describe a little bit how each of these might have affected me. So it's important that Mormon culture was, like Mormonism, was a very big part of my life growing up. It often made me very unique. I was sometimes the only Mormon in my school or town. So it had a very important impact on the way I saw the world. But it was definitely not the only thing. Growing up in Western Canada meant that I was relatively individualistic and had a relatively independent self, because that's how Canadians kind of are on average. It meant that being distinctive was important to me. A big part of Canadian identity is not being American, to be perfectly frank. And so it's important to maintain that distinctiveness. If you a Canadian can identify all the Canadian actors and pop stars, because it's important that this person isn't claimed by Americans, you know? And Mormons, I think, can relate to this sense of wanting to be distinctive and identifying Mormons that people don't know are Mormon. It was also important to me because Mormonism has this huge, like, Utah American influence. It was important to me that I couldn't just be a prototypical Mormon. I was a Canadian Mormon, so that affected the way that I lived my Mormonism. Being Canadian meant that I thought a certain way about multiculturalism and diversity. So even though Canada was definitely imperfect in the way it approaches diversity, it was a value that was instilled into kids in school, so I thought about things differently. It meant that as part of my Mormonism, I thought about foreign members differently. I thought about the people in my mission, the Latinos in East Los Angeles. I thought about them differently, probably because of being raised in Western Canada. Being a white male meant that I saw people who looked like me positively and abundantly represented in the world around me. And that absolutely had an impact on the way I thought about myself and the things that I thought were possible for me. And this is also absolutely true within a Mormon context. I saw Mormons who looked like me positively and abundantly portrayed all around me in leadership positions, in stories, the heroes in the scriptures, and so on. And so that definitely impacted the way that I experienced Mormonism. Growing up in small rural towns meant that I was exposed to relatively more conservative political and social ideologies. It meant that I was not exposed to a lot of diversity in my daily life. It was very easy for me to fit in with kind of the Mormon culture. There were very few challenges to the ways that I thought about myself and the ways that I thought about the church because of this lack of exposure to diversity and because of the relative kind of match between that environment and kind of Mormonism in a lot of ways. Not always, but in a lot of ways. To tie it into Past Peter again real quick, this lack of diversity meant that Past Peter wasn't exposed to very many, definitely no positive exemplars of LGBT individuals. I had pretty much no positive experience with them, and pretty much no direct experience with them. And so that affected the way that I thought about that issue. Growing up, lower socioeconomic status meant that my family had less money, fewer material resources, and fewer opportunities. So this definitely affected the way I thought about myself, the way I interacted with the world, and what I thought was possible for me. within the church. It affected the way others treated me. I had probably a different relationship with things like service and church welfare because of my lower socioeconomic status. My family was the recipient of service projects, these like Secret Santas at Christmas time and that kind of stuff. My family benefited from the Bishop's Storehouse and those sorts of things. And so that gave me a different personal experience and probably made me think a little bit differently about those aspects of Mormonism. It also affected the way I interpreted scriptures. And I've had this experience with some people in my life thinking about like, what are the most important parts of King Benjamin's speech or something. For me, the "Are we not all beggars?" was a really important and impactful one because it had this meaning to me that I don't think it had to more affluent and higher SES Mormons. And so, considering all of this, like all that we've talked about, how deeply culture affects us and how there are all these other ingredients in my life, for example, in all of our lives that are influencing us, why should past Peter have thought any differently? In hindsight, I wish I had thought differently and I wish I'd been a little quicker to change my mind about things, but given the cultural context that I was exposed to, it would have been highly unusual for 23-year-old Peter to think any differently than I did about homosexuality. Now, I understand that my past attitudes, at least in my opinion, you are welcome to disagree, but in my opinion, my past attitudes contributed to a social status quo that I think is harmful to a lot of people. And looking back, I regret that. But I also understand that, I think about what it would have taken, what it did take for me to change my mind about this, and all the things that were, all the obstacles that were in place. I think it's also important to think about how Mormonism wasn't the only thing that impacted my attitudes about that issue. In rural Western Canada, the Mormon view on homosexuality was not unique. It was very common for me to be able to kind of ignore those issues and be dismissive of LGBT individuals and ridicule them. It was very normal and acceptable for me to do that growing up. So as regretful as that is, as much as I wish that wasn't the case for myself, that was what was normal and accepted and good in the cultural context I was raised in. And it's also true that there were opportunities for me to learn about this topic and change my attitudes, but it's likely that I didn't recognize the opportunities when they came, and it's also likely that when there was an opportunity, my cultural context was leading me to perceive that opportunity in a certain way that made me less likely to take advantage of that opportunity and engage in a productive way around that issue. And so this brings me to the second part of the talk, and it's the quicker part, again, because I don't want to make it seem like my main goal is to, I want everybody to go out and persuade everybody right now, but I think it's important to think about, given the nature of our interactions with the people we disagree with, and given what we know about how much and how deeply their cultural contexts are affecting the way that they see the world, why would we expect them to change their mind about that issue we disagree about? And think about your own mind as well. I imagine that most of us in this room have undergone some changes of our minds, and probably some big ones. And I want you to think about, as we go through this, the last little bit of this talk, about what the ingredients were, what had to be in place for you to change your mind. And did it happen quickly or did it happen slowly? And so again, I just want to make it very clear, I'm not here to tell you what the right way to think is. I have some views. I think they're the best views, that's why I hold them, but the point is not to talk about what my views are. I want to talk about the nature of our disagreements and how we approach them. And then also important, changing somebody's mind is not always the primary goal of an interaction with somebody else. Sometimes we're in an interaction involuntarily with somebody we disagree with. Sometimes our goal is to get out of that interaction. Sometimes our goal is to kind of defend our identities or validate ourselves in some way. And the goal is less about persuading and it's more about making ourselves feel safe and valued, which is absolutely valuable and important. So I'm going to drastically oversimplify research on social influence here, but generally speaking, what research says changes minds is when the persuader is seen as similar to the target, when they're seen as credible, when they're seen as likable, and when they're seen as, and when they're familiar with their audience, with the target. A target has to be willing and able to consider new information, so they have to be both motivated to listen, and they have to be physically capable. They can't be distracted or under the influence or anything like that. They have to be physically able to consider new information. And a target has to feel safe and comfortable. And if we have all this other stuff in place, then a strong argument is good to have. It might be effective, but not always. But most people, I think it's safe to say most people think that a strong argument is all you need. And I want to make the case that without considering all this other stuff, and especially the safe and comfortable part, which is where the culture will come in, it's really difficult for any kind of mind-changing to happen. And so think about past Peter again. Think about how a pro-LGBT person would have appeared to me to past Peter. That person probably wouldn't have seemed very similar to me, probably wouldn't have seemed very credible or likable. I would have thought that they didn't know anything about me. I wouldn't have felt very safe and comfortable in an interaction with that person for a variety of reasons, some of which in hindsight are fairly trivial, but that's the truth, is that I probably wouldn't have felt comfortable in that interaction. And so how culture fits in is that these systems, these cultural systems that we belong to are very important to us, even if we're not totally aware of how influential they are. They're very important to us. They help us understand what our purpose is, what we're supposed to be doing here, who we are. And we are strongly motivated to be correct about those things. And we will instinctively defend our worldviews from threat. Research shows that when we feel our worldview is threatened, we get more defensive, both physically and emotionally defensive. We tend to be more punitive toward out-group members when our worldview is threatened. We ignore information that doesn't conform to our worldview, no matter how detailed or correct that information is, and we distance ourselves from people who are the source of that threat to our worldview. And so this applies to all worldviews, everybody in here, to myself, ex-Mormon worldviews, everybody. I am highly motivated to be correct in the way that I see the world. And I am very resistant to efforts to change the way that I see the world because I think it's so correct. And so to make this more personal, I just want you to consider some questions. What does it feel like to be wrong about something small or big? I imagine it sucks for most people to be wrong even about small things. And think about what it means to be wrong about something big. Are Mormon disagreements about small things or big things? The things that we disagree about, what happens if we think that disagreement has life or death consequences, or if that disagreement casts doubt on the way that I understand my purpose and meaning in life. Think about under what conditions are you comfortable being wrong about something small, about something big. And ask yourself, are those the conditions that exist when you're engaging with the people you disagree with? And so what do we do about this? Research suggests that we need to be able to identify and affirm their values before anything else. And so this is specifically with regards to cultural worldview defense. You need to be able to convince that person that you understand, or at least have tried to understand, how and why their cultural worldviews matter to them. And so affirming somebody means identifying and basically saying something nice about one of the cultural ingredients that is important to that person. And it's likely that you share some of these things in common. So if you can identify a common value and let that person know that that is something that is important, you understand why it's important to them and it's important to you, that will help reduce the likelihood of this cultural worldview defense tendency. And so, to start my wrap up, I want to paint a picture of two people, two Mormons. They have Mormonism in common, and that's important. It will allow us to make a variety of assumptions about those people. But what we often fail to do is consider how these people are different. All of the other ingredients that are influencing their thoughts and behaviors and attitudes. And when people like these disagree, where does the blame for the disagreement go? It usually goes to a salient identity, something that is obvious or relevant or something, and we rarely think about all the other things going on behind the scenes. And so what often happens, it's much easier to use a dispositional attribution that, oh, I disagree with Peter because he's a bad person, or I disagree with Peter because he's a Mormon. It's really easy to use those kinds of strategies, but as I hope we've learned, that fails to consider a whole bunch of other very, very important information. And so the takeaways of all of this is that our cultures profoundly affect us in ways that we don't think about and are often not aware of. Mormon culture is only one of the cultures that we have, and all of these cultures, they're not independent of each other. They're influencing each other all the time. With so many Mormons, with so many Mormonisms, disagreement is inevitable, and I think that's a common experience for everybody in this room. Disagreement about Mormon stuff is hard because of how crucial and important cultural Mormon things are to people's worldviews and their understanding of what's good and what's normal. And then what I think is that a greater awareness of these cultural factors behind our disagreements can help us disagree better. And so again, just to wrap up by reiterating what I said at the beginning, culture is important because it tells us what is normal, what is good, who we are, how to think, and it teaches us what disagreement means and how to disagree. And we rarely think about how important and influential all those things are when we are disagreeing with people in our real lives. And so again, I hope that when we leave here today, when we encounter somebody that we disagree with, that if your goal is to like work on changing that person's mind, if you're in a safe place where you feel comfortable engaging in that kind of discussion, think about these questions. Given that person's life history, why should they think differently? Given the way our interaction is going, why should they think differently? And to wrap up, I'm going to leave you with a quote from the cultural anthropologist Clifford Geertz. He says, "One of the most significant facts about humanity may finally be that we all begin with the natural equipment to live 1,000 kinds of life, but end in the end having lived only one." And for me, as a social psychologist, I am endlessly fascinated by how powerful and impactful our social environments are. There are so many things in our social worlds that influence the way we think about ourselves and our place in the world. Each of us is subject to these influences, and consequently, we are each the unique product of a particular combination of cultural ingredients. And this is especially important to remember when we're disagreeing with people and when we're trying to bridge differences between ourselves and others. If we remember that the people we disagree with and who are different from us have a different set of cultural ingredients and they are usually just trying to behave consistently with reality as they see it, I think it will help us view them more positively and make it easier for us to interact with them, bridge our differences, and solve the problems that arise from our differences. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. We have a couple of minutes. I'll grab one of the microphones and we can do some question and answer. This should work. Oh, there we go.
Nice presentation. I just want to comment that Mormonism in many ways makes it more difficult by some of the thinking assumptions we make. One of those is we not only feel safe in a certain way, but we throw in that baggage that if you are wrong, if this isn't right, you are displeasing God, you are displeasing the prophet. And another one we throw in is you're responsible for your family. You know, the empty chair, like my mother, in the table of the hereafter. That somehow if there is another thought entertained, that I am going to lose that eternal connection. So besides all the cultural contexts, you know, and all the different cultural things, I think Mormonism has some assumptive beliefs that make it more difficult for people to question because the loss is greater. I'd like you to comment on that.
Sure. I mean, I worry about oversimplifying everything to just like that one sentence from my presentation, but the way that Mormon belief developed, I think probably is a result of the cultural context in which it developed. And so the importance of family to Mormons isn't unique to Mormons. It's a product of a certain set of cultural ingredients that were in place when Mormonism was developing. And so you are absolutely correct that need to have and maintain and preserve that eternal family is really strong in Mormonism. I would say that's part of what a Mormon cultural context gives you, but it's also part of what other broader cultural things add into Mormonism. So I think it's one of those things that is where Mormonism both influences and is influenced by other cultural context. And I think that things like our degree of individualism and collectivism will influence how important it is to maintain that family unit. So I don't know that there's been research done on this, but my hunch would be that like white American Mormons are probably a little more willing to take that risk of losing their eternal family than, say, more collectivistic, more interdependent Latino Mormons, for example. I don't know that that's actually the case. I would love to hear if anybody knows about research, but that's what I would suspect because of these other cultural forces going on.
But it's also the concept of absolute truth.
The concept of absolute truth. This is true in any other way. We're not unique in that way, but we're pretty strong there that
yeah.
If you go in another path, you will pay eternal consequences, both individually and collectively.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of Mormonism's unique cultural ingredients. It's one of the unique things, or somewhat unique things that it adds, the strength with which it says that this is the only way, the only true thing. I think that makes Mormonism kind of unique. Other questions?
Yeah. Quick question on in discussing disagreements. I think one of the problems I have seen is there is a nexus of interrelated factors in Mormonism. So if I turn around and talk to someone about women's rights and equality, and they, for a moment, grasp the concept, there is a knock-on effect on other ideas, which are not directly spoken about, but they are there. So if they suddenly realize that women's equality and their right to lead, then that means the priesthood structure is wrong. My leaders aren't doing what they're supposed to. There's too many complexities, and I think that's one of the problems in Mormonism. It's just a big nexus. And trying to get one issue, you can't. Because it
yeah.
just...
Yeah, and I don't know exactly how to address that, but it definitely ties into what I was talking about, because it's because of how resistant we are to threats to our worldview. And so if talking about a certain issue, and so for me, this was probably the case with the homosexuality in the past. Like, it was like, I feel like we're maybe being a little more unkind than we should towards LGBT individuals, but I knew in my head what could happen if I seriously engaged with that topic. And so that's that cultural worldview defense going into action. It's I am not going to expose myself to a potential threat to the way I understand the world and my place in it. And so that's one of the very, very, very challenging things about talking about these kinds of issues. When your worldview is at stake, it's really hard to move beyond that.
Hi, thanks for the great presentation. I don't know if this would fall under your expertise, but I was just turning to her and say, well, part of it is we're such a young religion, really, a couple hundred years versus, you know, Catholics or a few thousand years. I just spoke with a Catholic priest, and I was asking him about, I just brought up LDS religion, and he said, oh, yeah, Mormons are like pre-Vatican II, and that's a guess. I had to ask him. It's when they became more big tent, and so as a whole system, culture, I'm not sure what my question is, but just how do you know, have you studied that, like a whole organization kind of maturing, the system maturing and getting to, we're still just trying to form our identity. Actually, I think we're maybe in the crisis of maybe moving to a next level, but we're still like either or, black or white. This is who we are. That's who we're not.
Yeah.
Versus we can become more big tent and that's not going to threaten our identity.
Yeah. So I don't know this like specific research on that, but the research on like group distinctiveness, so it's optimal distinctiveness is a term that's used, but this idea, like how I wanted to make sure nobody mistook me for an American growing up in Canada, like, and Mormons, I think part of being a young, like relatively small religion is that it's very important to be distinctive. And so the trade-off to become this big tent thing that accepts a wider variety of people would make Mormonism less distinctive. And so I think in that way, that could be one reason why Mormonism as a kind of institution is resistant to that kind of change, because it would make them less distinctive. And it would and perhaps imply that their cultural worldview is a little bit less correct. And so I think that's probably a reason we're resistant to that.
This is going to be our last question because we have like 2 minutes.
Politically, I've been a blue person in a red ward all my life.
Good for you.
And intuitively, I've done much of what you've discussed to get along. But over the last 20 years, it seems like the world view of the red people has drifted to another planet. Their facts are not my facts. And it's hard to even relate or have a conversation, at least on some issues, because sky's not blue in their world. Illustration. I believe the unemployment rate's about 4%, just under 5. They think it's over the roof, the unemployment, and they talk that way, and the economy's on the edge of collapse, and all kinds of things. And anyway, do you have some insight how we're living on different planets, practically?
I think a lot of what I talked about feeds into it. Okay, I'm going to try to make this as concise as possible. I would love to talk about this more after, but I think what makes the present day a little bit different than the past is in part due to the excessive amounts of information that we're exposed to and our ability to carefully tailor the information that we're exposed to. And so we are exposed, we can choose to expose ourselves to people who agree with us all the time, and that makes that, I think, is a major contributor to the degree of polarization across a lot of issues. Politically is the obvious example, but across a lot of issues. Mormons do this all the time, Mormons and ex-Mormons, is we become polarized, we exclude people who are not like us from our lives, and that leads to more polarization and more difficulty bridging the gaps. And so what my advice would be is to practice, and it sounds like you're already pretty good at this probably, but practice finding those common values. And when you disagree about something, what's the value underlying that? So I try to encourage my friends to do this with, I am left-leaning, so I try to encourage my friends to do this with Donald Trump and his supporters, when they say something, even if we think the information is like totally false and doesn't represent reality, what's the value underneath that? When they are saying that no Muslim should come into the country, the value underneath that is that they are worried about their safety. They want to feel safe in their own country. And I think we can all agree that that's a worthwhile value. But I think we rarely reach that common point when we're thinking about Donald Trump and his supporters. We just think, oh, that's a really hateful thing to do. You might disagree, but we rarely get to that common cultural core at the bottom of our disagreements. And that's, I think, it's something that doesn't come naturally. It's really hard, especially if you think that the other person's views are causing harm or something like that. But I think it's something that's worth practicing.
thank you so much. We are out of time, but if you would like to go out, thank you, Peter Levitt.